The electoral system and parliamentary reform. In this lecture, I want to look at the nature of the franchise before 1832, the voters, who they were and how they voted, and the pressure that led to the reform of the electoral system eventually in 1832. Finally, did 1832 change anything? In general, historians have emphasised the unsavoury nature of electoral politics in the 18th century, stressing its corruption and venality. There have been variations. So, for example, historians writing about elections and politics in the so-called period of the Rage of Party between 1701 and 1715 have argued that in this period, electoral participation and activity was high. They base these assertions on the size of the electorate, around one in four adult males could vote, and also the opportunity for voters to exercise the right to vote. The Triennial Act of 1694 meant there were elections every 3 years. However, even these historians write dismissively of the Hanoverian electorate. They argue that very few voters were free to vote as they wished, that the electorate was thoroughly venal, there was very little opportunity to vote, and that politics and ideology had little part to play in election contests. These assumptions have been challenged, most notably by Franco Gorman and John Phillips. They argued that the electoral system was controlled at times, but with great difficulty. That it was never closed, and electoral politics became an increasingly active and participatory experience. As the period advanced, for example, the rise of the press and the growth of an articulate and educated public opinion steadily raised political consciousness. And finally, they argue that electoral politics was intrinsically local, and thus it's difficult to come up with a definitive version of national electoral politics. Turning to the franchise then, the franchise was a curious mix of systems dating back to the medieval period and based on these areas of wealth and population. English counties based their representation on an Act of 1430, which enabled 40 shilling freeholders to possess the vote. Thus, it was a uniform franchise. The borough representation was more complicated and can roughly be divided into five different categories. The first were the 55 inhabitant boroughs. Here, all residents could vote, although the way of determining who was a resident differed from constituency to constituency. Secondly, there were 41 burgage boroughs. Burgages were ancient pieces of real estate and property from which the right to vote was derived. Thirdly, there were 19 corporation boroughs, where the right to vote was restricted to members of the corporation, typically the mayor, aldermen, and common councilmen. Virtually all of these boroughs were venal and corrupt. Fourthly, there were 100 freeman boroughs, where the freeman of the town could vote. The freedom of the borough was also a medieval institution and was gained by inheritance, by purchase, or by apprenticeship. Lastly, were the two university towns of Oxford and Cambridge. Here, the franchise was restricted to doctors and masters of arts of the universities. In each constituency, around 300 voted, but the number entitled to do so was obviously higher. There was thus a bewildering mass of borough franchises, and it's not possible merely to categorise burgage boroughs as corrupt and freemen as open. The situation is much more complex. Turning briefly to look at Wales, Scotland and Ireland then. In Wales, there were 12 one-member counties and 12 one-member boroughs. The county franchise was a 40 shilling freehold, and the boroughs were divided into one corporation borough, 9 freeman boroughs and 2 inhabitant boroughs, with small electorates ranging from 80 to 2,000. Scotland joined the English system after 1707. Here there were 31 member counties and 15 districts of boroughs, each returning one MP, thus totalling 45 seats in all. Both boroughs and counties were venal. Boroughs employed a method of indirect election, and in counties, the property qualifications were high, meaning the electorates were small, ranging from 21 to 240 voters. In Ireland, there were 32 two-member counties, two two-member boroughs, Cork and Dublin, 31 one-member boroughs, and the university seat of Trinity College, Dublin, returning a total of 100 MPs. The Irish system dated from the Act of Union of 1801, which had abolished the old Irish boroughs and counties and reformed them. Most boroughs were under close control, but in counties there was more chance for independent action. So, for example, in 1828, Daniel O'Connell was elected for County Clare. Although as a Catholic, he was not eligible to sit in the Commons. All of this means, then, that it's very difficult to ascertain who a typical voter was in the 18th century, what their status was, even if they were male or female. Women were not excluded from the franchise by law. This was an innovation of the 1832 Reform Act. And whilst there's little evidence of women voting, Elaine Challis has uncovered evidence of women appointing male proxies to vote on their behalf. Information on who voted and how they voted comes from surviving poll books. Throughout the 18th century, then, there are increasing numbers of debates about reform of the electoral system. And these discussions can be grouped roughly into three. Firstly, those wanting so-called economic reform. These measures were often supported by the Tories. They wanted to better reflect the distribution of property in the country in order to counter the perceived corruption of electorate. They argued there should be more seats in counties and that pensioners and government placeholders should be removed from the electorate. The second group were those who wanted a fairer representation of interests in order to reflect the changing economic and social circumstances of the country in the 18th century. Thus, they wanted to eliminate some of the rotten boroughs and redistribute their seats to major unrepresented towns. However, they did not want to represent people, but interests. Thus, the main premise of the electoral system should not be changed. And lastly, those who wanted more radical proposals, a broader franchise, redistribution of seats, shorter parliaments, and secret ballot. The mood in Parliament then began to change at the turn of the 19th century. The radicals organised themselves from groups of malcontents outside Parliament with differing aims and ideas to a compact caucus within the Commons, and started to introduce small pieces of legislation trying to chip away at the resistance to reform. Their main success was in 1820, when a bill disenfranchised the rotten borough of Grampound and redistributed their seats to Yorkshire. However, it was clear for any larger measure of reform to take place, they would have to have the support of the established leadership of the Whig Party in the Commons. This began to happen in the late 1820s. Grey, for instance, the leader of the Whigs, began to respond to the changing situation. And on the Tory side, the new mood of liberal Toryism also faced a change on the Tory party. John Russell introduced two bills for the reform of Penrhyn and East Retford. These were passed in the Commons, but thrown out in the Lords, an early warning of the future difficulties that would lie in that house. With the onset of depression in the winter of 1829 to 30, the reform agitation outside Parliament in the country began to revive, spearheaded by the formation of new political unions. In July 1829, the London Radical Association was formed, but more importantly, in December 1829, the Birmingham Political Union, led by Thomas Attwood, was founded. In London, Francis Place formed his National Political Union in October 1831, aimed at coordinating agitation, but it failed to replace the Birmingham Political Union as leader of the movement. And William Lovett and Hetherington set up a rival body, the National Union of the Working Classes. The death of George IV removed another obstacle to reform. On his death, as was customary, Parliament was dissolved and the MPs went to the country. Although very few seats were contested in the 1830 election, everywhere in their constituencies, MPs were brought face to face with the weight of public opinion, which it was clear was for reform. On the 17th of November 1830, then, for the first time, a ministry pledged to parliamentary reform, led by Earl Grey, took office. Immediately on gaining office, Grey appointed a four-member committee to draft reform proposals. They extensively redistributed seats. They were in favour of the secret ballot, but recommended a qualification of £20 to mitigate the effects of the ballot. They also wanted to introduce five-year parliaments, non-residents should lose their right to vote, more polling places should be provided, and voters should be registered. The legislation went through a number of trials and tribulations. In all, three reform bills were introduced. Eventually, a measure got through the Commons and the Lords under threat of the creation of peers, and in September 1832 the Third Reform Act was passed. The first election to be held on the new franchise was December 1832. This kept the 40 shilling freehold franchise, and in the boroughs there was a £10 household franchise, although the measure for secret ballot was thrown out. So does 1832 change anything? 1832 had a number of political effects, particularly regarding the power of the aristocracy, the House of Lords, the established Anglican Church, and public opinion. It also had a number of electoral effects. Many small pocket boroughs were disenfranchised, but Norman Gash has estimated that over 40 survived. Eight English boroughs had less than 200 voters, for example. Peers could still send their nominees to sit in the lower house. A number of constituencies in the ensuing 20 years after the Act was passed were disenfranchised for gross and systematic venality and corruption. However, it is also possible to be more positive about the new electoral system. Firstly, the benefits of registration, which were inaugurated by the Act. Registration acted as a boost to party organisation and introduced new electoral practices. Secondly, the number of voters who actually voted in elections increased dramatically after 1832. Over three times as many people voting after the Great Reform Act when compared with the decade before. Turnout rates were high, often above 90% in the 1830s. Lastly, the Reform Act ushered in a period where almost universally partisan voting was the norm. Reform then did make a difference. To use John Phillips's words, the Reform Act expanded the ranks of the enfranchised, catalysed partisan politics, and reshaped the political process in constituency after constituency across the country. Not merely the first, but the Great Reform Act established a new pattern of politics that began the inexorable movement towards parliamentary democracy.